Good morning, everyone.
Wow.
We are checking the sound. How's the sound today?
Good.
Can everyone hear?
Yeah.
Ruth, can you hear? Yes, Ruth can hear. Excellent. Good. I will try to keep my voice up and not mumble. I think of the sound system as being this magical thing that I can mumble and you'll be able to hear me, but apparently this is not the case. So I will speak up louder, and I have to depend on all of you to tell me when you can't hear. And so if you can't hear and you're not telling me, I'm not going to know. And if you feel shy about saying, hey, I can't hear, because then people will think you can't hear, just wave your arm, Ruth, wave your arm, and nobody will know, because they are looking at me. They're not going to see you, but I'll see you, and I'll know to speak up so that you can hear me. And what usually happens after a while is John comes over and says, it's too loud. Don't shout. It's too loud. Just talk in a nice, normal voice. Don't talk too loudly. Maybe you should mumble. How's this voice? All I have to do is remember the whole time to keep my voice just exactly at this level. Okay, is there anything else to talk about other than whether or not you can hear me? But someone said, it's not you that I can't hear, it's Ashvaghosa. Well, as I told you at the beginning of the practice period, I was a little afraid of that. And so I'm not that surprised. Ashvaghosa is a rather thick syrup, hard to get down. But I think that is characteristic of all Buddhist teachings and all religious teachings. You know, after a while, they thicken up. So it's hard to get them down. But we decided that we would read The Awakening of Faith anyway, because like castor oil, you know, it's good for you. And on the one hand, it is a big drag to study religious texts that you don't appreciate, understand, or resonate with. On the other hand, if you only study the stuff you like and understand and agree with, what good is it? You know, how are you ever going to get past yourself? And I know that this is not true for everyone. Many of you, I know, are appreciating The Awakening of Faith a lot. And of course, as you see, I'm trying my best to make it amusing as it can be, anyway. How come we have texts like this anyway? I really think that fundamentally our Buddhist ancestors did discover something about life that they experienced directly and that they really, really felt. They felt the passion and the beauty and the immensity of this human life. And they felt love and they felt compassion on a very, very profound level. And they felt a great sympathy for all of life. And they could see how much we suffered, more than we ourselves know, I think. And they wanted to help. And they saw that they could help by giving us a way of practice, the way that they themselves had practiced, and a teaching that would point us in the right direction. And so they did their best within the categories of their traditions to speak in a way that would help us, and in a way that would avoid the many mistakes that we were bound to make in our understanding. And they were trying hard not to create yet another ideology, yet another way for us to suffer and misunderstand. They really, really wanted us to be free of birth and death by completely becoming birth and death. It occurred to me the other day, I saw it in my mind, you know. Maybe you've seen this. Once I saw it in Europe, and lately, actually I saw it, Kathy and I saw it outside the San Francisco International Airport while we were waiting for the bus, a murmuration of birds. Have you seen that? It's an amazing phenomenon. Huge numbers of birds coming together in a pattern and then swooping away from that pattern and forming another pattern and swooping away from that pattern into another pattern, appearing, disappearing, dissolving, swooping, soaring. You watch it, it just takes your breath away. You can't believe this is happening in front of your eyes. And I think we feel our lives like that. I think our lives actually really are like that. What we call you and me is a momentary coming together of many elements into a lovely and absolutely unrepeatable pattern that emerges immediately and falls away just as immediately, swoops and reforms into a new pattern. And that's our living and dying, moment after moment after moment. The great essayist Michel de Montaigne wrote an essay called "That to Philosophize is to Learn to Die." Great title for an essay, right? That to philosophize is to learn to die. And in this essay, he writes about how crazy it is that we have so much fear. We have so much fear. And he believes that the root of all of our fears is the fear of death, the fear of not being. Even when we're not afraid of death, that's what we're really afraid of, he says. And then he writes about all the crazy things that people do to avoid this fear, and all the even crazier things they do when they can't avoid the fear and they're, you know, obsessed with it. And he says, this is all so stupid because death is a natural and an essential phenomenon. And it doesn't hurt us. Of all the things in this world that hurt us, death is the one thing that doesn't hurt. Life hurts. Yeah, but death doesn't hurt at all. Because we're not there. And he writes, go out of this world as you entered it. The same passage you made from death to life without feeling or fright, make it again from life to death. Your death is part of the order of the universe. It is part of the life of the world. And then he quotes Lucretius, who we talked about yesterday, who says very beautifully, we borrow our lives from each other. And people, like runners, pass on the torch of life. And we can remember with a lot of feeling and gratitude those who passed on that torch to us. And then, confident that we would carry on, left us. And now it's our turn to run for a little while. And then we'll turn around and pass the torch. And they'll run. And on the torch is passed from one to the next to the next. And I'm sure there would be no religion and no art and no philosophy if there were no death. And certainly there would be no life at all if there weren't death. Ruth, can you hear me? Yay, all right.
And I can read your lips.
And you can read my lips. Good. And for sure there would be no awakening of faith if there were no life and death and fear and human suffering and our need to find a way to do what ought to be done as simply as Montaigne suggests, but usually it isn't that simple. It's not that simple. It should be so simple, but it doesn't seem to be so simple to live and die with gratitude and compassion. And that's what the awakening of faith is trying to tell us how to do. It is literally trying to awaken us to faith in what it calls our own mind. Faith in reality itself as our best friend. It wants to help us little by little to disidentify with the small picture of our life that is so enchanting, and more identify with the big picture of our life, which is beyond life and death, and is within and withon and beyond this world. And that's why we're reading the text, and we always keep that in mind. We try to stay out of the weeds, you know, of all the Buddhist doctrinal stuff. Because we're not reading it as a study of Mahayana Buddhist doctrine. You could read it that way, and I think that would be interesting and helpful, but we're not reading it that way. We're reading it as a literal description of our actual lived experience, which is the point, anyway, of Mahayana Buddhist doctrine. But this is a little tricky because when I say lived experience, I don't mean those words the way we usually take them. I mean them in a more literal way. I mean our actual experience of living itself, not our various experiences of this and that. Because our experiences of this and that occur by virtue of our senses and our mind. We can name our experiences, we can understand them, we can take photos of them and send them to our friends on the text. And they can understand, oh yeah, she experienced that. They experienced that. In order to have those experiences though, there's one important condition. We have to be alive to begin with. But when you have experiences, you take for granted, right, that you're alive. What a great expression. Every time I hear it or say it, I'm amazed by it, to take for granted. Isn't it a great expression? Because it means exactly the opposite of what it says. Things actually are granted to us. Every moment of life is granted to us because it might be gone, taken from us. But no, it's granted to us. In fact, every moment is gone, is taken from us, but then a new moment is granted to us. Granted to us for no reason at all. The pattern appears, it's beautiful, it disappears. A new pattern appears. And the expression taken for granted means just the opposite of that. It means that we don't recognize that life is granted for us, that we didn't earn, that we don't earn life, we don't keep life, it's granted to us. To take it for granted means to ignore this and just assume life or whatever else we take for granted is going to be there. We just take it for granted. To practice is not to assume that we are alive, but to know that we are alive and to feel our aliveness, not to expect to be alive, but to see that life is always unexpected. And sometimes, and I think you all know what I mean, sometimes in a flash, in some kind of crazy, oddball moment, some kind of off-the-books moment, a moment that sometimes we can barely even experience. Did that happen or not? We feel it. We feel this. That's what I mean by lived experience. The experience that we are alive and that life is granted to us. So when we read The Awakening of Faith, we're reading it as a text that's about this. Steeped in Buddhist language and thought, Ashvaghosa expresses it in the way he does, but we have to try to see past his form of expression and see what he really means by what he says. Though we can't explain it, because any explanation would be misleading. But we can somehow get it. We can somehow feel it. We can understand it in some other way. And doesn't Zazen help, right? Zazen helps a lot to have that kind of understanding of it. And we're reading the text in the glow of Zazen, especially this week. Even if the mind doesn't comprehend in the way we're used to comprehending, which can be frustrating, even so, we do know. And should we be able to comprehend the text, then we would understand that our comprehension doesn't touch it, because the text keeps saying that over and over again. So now I'll read you a poem. This is a poem by J.H. Prim, who died about a week or two ago. And Hank, I guess, knows him. I didn't know J.H. Prim and didn't read him until he died. And then I looked up some of his poems. And this is a great poem of J.H. Prim called Moon Poem. It's a little long, and you have to relax in order to listen to it. Try not to figure out what it means, because that will only either frustrate you or make you angry. Can you still hear me, Ruth? Am I fading? I'm fading.
I'm sorry.
I'm fading a little bit. I must be, because you didn't hear that, yeah. Okay, I will try to read this poem of J.H. Prim with a loud voice, although it doesn't want to be read in a loud voice, but I'll read it in a loud voice anyway. Moon Poem. The night is already quiet, and I am bound in the rise and fall, learning to wish always for more. This is the means, the extension to keep very steady, so that the culmination will be silent too and flow with no trace of devoutness. Since I must hold to the gradual in this as no revolution, but a slow change like the image of snow, the challenge is not a moral excitement, but the expanse, the continuing patience dilating into forms so much more than compact. I would probably not even choose to inhabit the wish as delay. It really is dark, and the knowledge of the unseen is a warmth which spreads into the level ceremony of diffusion. The quiet suggests that the act taken extends so much farther. There is this insurgence of form. We are more pliant than the mercantile notion of choice will determine. We go in this way on, and the unceasing image of hope is our place in the world. We live there, And now at night, I recognize the signs of this. The calm is a modesty about conduct in the most ethical sense. We disperse into the ether as waves. We slant down in a precluded notion of choice, which becomes the unlearned habit of wish, where we live as we more often are than we know. If we expand into this wide personal vacancy, we could become the extent of all the wishes that are now too far beyond us. A community of wish as the step on which the extension would sprinkle out the ethic density, the compact modern home. The consequence of this pastoral desire is prolonged as our condition. But I know there is more than the mere wish to wander at large, since the wish itself diffuses beyond this and will never end. These are songs to the night under no affliction, knowing that the wish is a gift to the spirit, is where we may dwell as we would go over and over within the life of the heart and the grace which is both open to both East and West. These are psalms for the harp and the shining stone, the negligence and still passion of night. That's some poem, don't you think? Which I don't think I can understand. And I certainly couldn't explain it or paraphrase it. That would be impossible. Because its meaning is in the words themselves. And as we talked yesterday, every word, you know, has so much more meaning. That's the thing. When we read, we usually reduce a word to one little meaning. A poem tells us that words have so many more meanings, each one. So it's there in the words themselves. But I think all of us now, today, by now, we can feel this poem pretty well. Even if, you know, if some lines went over your head and you lost track of them and you forgot where you were, it doesn't make any difference. You just jump on the next one. And it's right there. Everything you need is in every line, every word. I have no idea, you know, J.H. Prynne was apparently mysteriously mysterious. He wouldn't have let himself be photographed very often. He never gave interviews. People knew very little about him. He was a Cambridge don, you know, a scholar of some sort of everything. He knew a lot of stuff about a lot of things, but people didn't know much about him. So I have no idea whether J.H. Prynne, you know, ever practiced Buddhism. I'm assuming he didn't. But when I read that poem, it feels to me like exactly what Ashwagosa is telling us. And we've remarked many times that in Zen there are a lot of expressions that seem to come right out of the awakening of faith. Zen style, of course, is the opposite of Ashwagosa's style. Zen style is not explaining anything. So Zen sayings are very stripped down and short. But you could say, well, Ashwagosa's explanations are non-explanations anyway, so it's the same thing. And one Zen saying that I thought of that is pretty much sums up the entire awakening of faith is Matsu saying, this very mind itself is Buddha. Isn't that what the awakening of faith is saying? This very mind itself is Buddha. And that's what we would like to have faith in, right? We would like to have faith. This very mind is Buddha, and we would like to know that and really have faith in that. So then somehow I, I remembered that this very mind is Buddha is the 16th question in Dogen's Bendowa. Somebody asks about this saying in Bendowa, and this is, I'll quote you what the question in Dogen's answer. Someone says, in Buddha Dharma, if you comprehend the meaning of mind itself as Buddha, that will be sufficient without any chanting of sutras or any other practicing of the Buddha way, to know that Buddha Dharma is originally the mind. That's the completion of attaining the way. Other than this, you don't need anything else. So why are you telling us to do zazen? You know, why should we do that? Why should we do anything else but just know that? And Dogen answers and says, no, that's not right. Because if that were right, then everybody who has a mind would immediately understand the meaning of Buddha Dharma. And you look around and you know that's not true. You should understand that Buddha Dharma is studied by giving up the view of self and other. Pretty simple, not so easy to do. If the understanding of self itself is Buddha, mind itself is Buddha, were the attaining of the way, Shakyamuni Buddha would not have taken the trouble to elucidate the way. And I will illuminate this to you with an excellent story of a Zen master, Dogen says, and now he tells you the story. Once a monk called Director Xuanzi was in the assembly of Zen master Fa Yan. Fa Yan asked him, Director Xuanzi, how long have you been in my community? And he said, the director said, 3 years. And Fa Yan said, well, why don't you ask me something about Buddha Dharma? Like, you've been here all this time, you didn't never spoke up. Why don't you say something? And Xuanzi said, well, I can't deceive you. When I was studying with Zen master Qingfeng, I mastered the state of ease and joy in Buddha Dharma. In other words, I don't really need to ask you anything. You know, I'm fine. And Fa Yan said, ah, well, with what words did you enter this understanding? And Xuanzi said, when I asked Qingfeng, what is the self of a Zen student, he answered me, the fire spirits are here to look for fire. I guess, meaning what you're looking for is already there. There's nothing to look for. Mind itself is Buddha, right? And Fa Yan said, oh, that's very good. Too bad you didn't understand it. And Xuanzi said, the fire spirits belong to fire, so I understood that fire looks for fire, and self looks for self. It's already here. So, right? And the master said, no, you didn't understand it. If Buddha Dharma were like that, it wouldn't have been transmitted all the way up to now. It would have died a long time ago. Then Xuanzi became very distressed. So much so that he left the monastery, you know, dejected, which is a very drastic thing to do. I mean, that's being distressed, right? And as he's on his way, he says to himself, you know, this master is known as a really good teacher. You know, there's 500 monastics in the assembly. They can't all be wrong. Maybe he has a point. Maybe I should go back. So he did. He went back. and he apologized for leaving, and he asked again, "What is the self of a Zen student?" And Fa Yan said, "The fire spirits are here to look for fire." Upon hearing this, Xuanzang had a great realization of Buddha Dharma. And once again, the Zen story has a happy ending. And Dogen then comments on the story. He says, "In this way, we know that mere recognition of self itself as Buddha is not penetrating Buddha Dharma. If the understanding of self itself is Buddha, mind itself is Buddha, were Buddha Dharma, Fa Yan would not have given such criticism or such guidance." Here's what you should do. Just inquire about the rules of practice as soon as you come to a practice place, and single-mindedly practice Zazen and pursue the way without leaving a half of an understanding in your mind. Then the excellent art of Buddha Dharma will not be in vain. In other words, you can't just read Ashwagosa. You know, you have to bow and chant and serve tea and do Zazen and then do Kinyin when you hear the two bells. And if you're the one striking the two bells beautifully, you have to do all that also. Okay, now I remind you that the Awakening of Faith has five parts. You will recall. Part one, the reasons for writing. Because why bother? He lets you know why. Part two, the outline. Part three, interpretation that we've been talking about for so long, we didn't even remember that we were in part three. But we finished it yesterday. Part four, on faith and practice. And part five, encouragement of practice and benefits thereof. So today, we start part four. And in the beginning of this part, Ashwagosa says that this part is written specifically for those who have not yet joined the group of beings who are determined to attain enlightenment. It's for those people. Well, what does that mean exactly? Does it mean the group of those who have received the prediction from the Buddha that at such and such a time and such a world they will become such and such a Buddha, and therefore they are assured of this, and there's no way they will ever go backwards, they can only go forward. This part is not for them. Or does it mean people who have committed themselves to going ahead, even if it's possible that in a future time they may slide back a little bit, they'll come back little by little. They won't turn back. They'll turn back, but maybe they'll back and forth a bit. And whichever is referred to, which group are we in? I'm not sure what group we're in. Maybe we should just skip this part, you know, because we're in the other group. But it's not that long, so in case we're in the other group, it won't hurt us probably to read this part. Anyway, the chapter has two main sections. You can still hear me, right? Ruth? Good. Two main sections. Four faiths and five practices. And I did, the first day I brought up this part, and I talked about the fifth, a little bit about the fifth of the five practices. So four faiths. Three of the four faiths, fortunately, we already know. Three of them are faith in the Triple Treasure. And we're expressing our faith in the Triple Treasure every morning when we chant the Triple Treasure and bow. Faith in the Buddha means faith in the awakened nature of our human consciousness, faith that that is possible in human consciousness, that that's built into our human consciousness, that we do have the capacity, every one of us without exception, to see for ourselves the compassionate, loving nature of reality, to wake up to it and live it. Faith in the Dharma means that we have faith that there is a path, that there is a way to realize and embody Buddha in our very lives. And faith in the Sangha means that we have confidence in the community of beings, which ultimately includes all beings, sentient and non-sentient, who are practicing together, encouraging and supporting one another in this endeavor. So that's three of the four faiths. And the fourth is faith in the source of all of this. Faith in suchness, in Dharmakaya, in isness, thusness, thisness, just thisness, whatever we want to call it. We call it many names, Tathagata, Tathagata Garbha, Buddha nature, the ultimate existence, non-existence of true reality as it really, really is. The three faiths. And fortunately, also the five practices are not unknown to us. We study them many times. The five practices are the six paramitas, with the last two collapsed into one, meditation and, you know, jhana and prajna, collapsed into one practice that Ashvaghosa calls, as we learned the other day, shamatha vipassana. Shamatha vipassana. Cessation and clear observation. So those are the six practices. And then our innocent questioner who keeps popping up in the text comes along and says, how do you practice these? And then Ashvaghosa explains each one. To practice giving, give alms to those in need, help all those in hardship, and give teachings to those who ask for them, but make sure that you do this not for any advantage or to make yourself feel good, but strictly for the purpose of benefiting them. To practice morality, follow the 10 clear mind precepts and feel fright, shame, and awesome remorse when you break them. He says that. Free yourself from greed, anger, cheating, jealousy, deceit, flattery, crookedness, and false views. And if you're a monastic, make sure you live in a quiet, secluded place. And if you're not a monastic, go to a place like that once in a while to straighten yourself out. Guard yourself from slander and dislike so as not to rouse people in their delusion to commit any offense or sin. Because if you slander somebody, they might like beat you up, and that would be terrible for them. Don't do that to them, is the idea. To practice patient forbearance, be patient with vexatious acts of others. And don't harbor thoughts of vengeance. And be patient in matters of gain or loss, honor or dishonor, praise or blame, suffering or joy. These are the famous eight worldly conceptions. It's thanks to these eight pairs, four pairs, of making eight, that we remain attached to the world of suffering. So instead of attaching to gain or loss, honor or dishonor, praise or blame, suffering or joy, be patient with both of them. That means be patient with joy. Don't get caught in it. Be patient with gain or honor. Don't get caught in it. And of course, be patient with dishonor. Don't insist that you not be dishonored when you are dishonored. Be patient with it. Practice experiencing them as they are with patience. And now I'll quote to you exactly what Ashvaghosa says about practicing joyful effort, just so that his weird ancient Buddhist voice can be in the room. And of course, he uses the male pronoun. He should not be sluggish in doing good. He should be firm in his resolution, and he should purge himself of cowardice. He should remember that from the far distant past, he has been tormented in vain by all of the great sufferings of body and mind. Because of this, he should diligently practice various meritorious acts, benefiting himself and others, and liberate himself quickly from suffering. Even if a person practices faith, because they are greatly hindered by the evil karma derived from the great sins of previous lives, they may be troubled by the evil tempter Mara and Mara's demons, or entangled in all sorts of worldly affairs, or afflicted by the sufferings of disease. And there are a great many hindrances like this. They should, therefore, always be courageous and zealous. And at the 6 4-hour intervals of the day and night, should pay homage to the Buddhas, repent with sincere heart, and beseech the Buddhas for their guidance. Rejoice in the happiness of others, and direct all the merit acquired by all of this to the attainment of full awakening. And if they never abandon these practices, they will be able to avoid the various hindrances, and their capacity for goodness will always increase. Zestful, joyous effort in practice, sparing nothing. Finally comes the last one, the fifth, shamatha vipassana. In introducing this two-part practice, Ashvaghosa says something interesting that I didn't really notice on first reading. He says that shamatha means cessation, very specifically. It means that through concentration, we would put a stop to all the characteristics of the world. That's what we should do. Put a stop to all the characteristics of the world. And the word characteristics here is a technical Buddhist word. It's a translation of the word lakshana, which is more often translated as marks. But characteristics is the same thing, more or less. And what it is the essence of discrimination. Where there's a mark, there is something to be noticed. So it's saying, more or less, that when you concentrate the mind, the sharp edges of the world will dissolve, or smooth over, so to speak. And everything will be equally this or that, without marks or characteristics that would cause you to dislike or like, or want to adjust or fix or change or run away from or grab something. Because you wouldn't have the same sharpness of characteristic of mark. You would have put it down. And this is something that we actually notice, I think, quite distinctly in Sesshin. I hope you're noticing this anyway. It would really be too bad if you weren't by now. That after a while, you know, several days go by, you know, and your attitude kind of softens. The thing that really pissed you off on the first day, you don't even care anymore. You know, it doesn't bother you at all. Everything is fine. The things that ordinarily annoy you don't annoy you anymore. because you no longer really even notice their various quite annoying characteristics. I hope that we're all, to some extent, feeling that, because if you don't feel at least a little bit of that, there is no worse thing that a human being could do than Sesshin. And I think you would be long gone by now. You wouldn't be sitting here now if you haven't at least a little bit experienced this. But what's interesting is that shamatha is to put a stop to the characteristics, but vipassana, and this is a direct quote, vipassana is to perceive distinctly the characteristics of the causally conditioned phenomenal world. In other words, samsara. To perceive distinctly the characteristics of the causally conditioned phenomenal world. So isn't that amazing? You practice shamatha to cease seeing the characteristics, and you practice vipassana to see the characteristics clearly. Now the trick here is that ordinarily, when we see what we think are the characteristics that are so annoying, we're not actually seeing the characteristics of the causally conditioned phenomenal world. Because there is so much me in everything we're seeing, right? There's a lot of me in it all the time. All my likes and dislikes are buried right in the middle of my perception of everything that's going on. So yes, I'm seeing these things, but I'm seeing them only through the lens of myself, and so I'm seeing them all in a fundamentally distorted way, which means I'm not seeing them at all. So the first thing I have to do is quiet down my mind, subdue myself, occupy my mind with breathing, with sensations, with the body, with moving through space, with just being present, with sound. In other words, less me and more the world coming forward instead of me grabbing the world. And then when my mind is a little bit quiet, I can see the characteristics as they actually are. Not just this and that, but characteristics of the causally conditioned phenomenal world as samsara. In other words, we see samsara as samsara, not as the ordinary everyday world that I have been projecting from my conditioning all the time. Same world. Same characteristics, but now we see them as connection, as empty, as patterns that beautifully come together and fall away moment after moment as the conditioned phenomena of this universe appearing right here in front of us, not in any way separate from consciousness, which is what they are and which is what produces them. So this kind of seeing the very same stuff in a different way is exactly what evokes in us feelings of deep, deep sympathy and deep, deep identity with everything that we're seeing, because it is exactly ourself. Not the self that's projecting, but the self that we really are. And that's why there's feelings of tremendous love and sorrow and compassion for everything, everything coming and going beautifully and so sadly in this world. That's the introduction to the two practices that comprise the fifth of the five practices. And that's maybe tomorrow. Maybe that's good for today. No more for today. How much can we take? <One day. laughs> Well, it is my personal observation. I don't know if you feel the same way, but it is my personal observation that time is advancing. And that we are coming, not long from now, to the last day of Sesshin, which makes this a very important time in our Sesshin, an important time to make sure that we keep very steady with our practice. It goes without saying that to begin to imagine today or tomorrow the end of Sesshin and all the wonderful things that you've been deprived of all week, that you will no longer be deprived of, and all the things that you're going to do when you're free of this tremendous restriction, that to think of that would be complete folly. Right? You know that. I don't have to say that, even though I just did. But that would be, don't even think it. It would be, I mean, nothing could be more stupid, right, than to think that. Because there's only steady ahead. That's all there is. There's only this day and the next and the next and the next and the next. Every moment takes care of itself. Every moment is complete, and every moment is all we need. Well, we're having a good time. Please, let's continue. Do take care of yourself, and in taking care of yourself and being really steady and really strict, as Suzuki Roshi says, with your practice, you're doing everybody else a big gift and a big favor. Let's keep doing that. Thank you very much, and I really hope that everybody could hear my talk today. If not, you can always listen later. Or not. What's the difference, really? Thank you. Yeah.